Frank opened the door of Rutherford Chamberlain's sitting room and looked out into the foyer. It was empty at the moment. As he started toward the library, the butler stepped into the hall at the far end. Dennis raised white eyebrows in surprise.
I came back to talk to Mr. Chamberlain.
Frank glanced toward the sitting room door, which was still open a crack. Nancy smiled gratefully at him through the gap.
I'll see if he's willing to speak to you again, sir.
Dennis knocked on one of the library doors, then went in. A moment later, he reappeared.
Please come in, Mr. Morgan.
Frank was glad that Chamberlain had agreed to see him again. They hadn't left things on a very cordial basis. Chamberlain was behind the big desk in the library.
What is it, Morgan?
I've changed my mind. I'll take the job.
You'll find the terror and kill it.
That's right.
May I ask what prompted this reversal?
I decided it was more important that you lift the bounty and get all those trigger-happy fools out of the woods.
Oh, and I suppose the $10,000 had nothing to do with it.
Possibly.
Well, I'm surprised by this, Morgan. I don't mind admitting it. I thought you were too stiff-necked to admit that you were wrong. But I'm glad you changed your mind. I put out the word about the bounty being lifted immediately. But it may take some time for it to reach everyone who's looking for the terror.
Make it as fast as you can.
Of course. We have a deal?
We have a deal.
Well, then let's have a drink to seal the bargain.
I appreciate the offer, but I'd like to get started on this job as soon as possible. Send a man into Eureka to spread the word about lifting the bounty. If you put up reward posters, have him take them down.
Very well. I'll take care of it this afternoon.
Thanks. I'll get going now.
Bring me his head, Morgan. Bring me the damn creature's head.
Dennis was waiting in the corridor. He followed Frank all the way to the front door of the bizarre Redwood Mansion this time. The two horses and Wolf were right where Frank had left them. Wolf probably hadn't moved since he sat down. The gunman called Rockwell lounged nearby on a wrought iron bench that didn't look the least bit comfortable. He stood up and sauntered over while Frank was untying his horse's reins.
You were in there quite a while. Strike a deal with the old man?
As a matter of fact, I did. I'm going to hunt down the terror, and Chamberlain's going to call off the bounty.
You got him to back down? I didn't think that was possible.
I offered him an arrangement he liked better, that's all.
I can tell you who's not going to like it. All those hombres who started wandering around in the woods looking for monsters, they all think they're going to be the one to kill the terror and collect that $10,000.
Chamberlain's going to send someone to town to spread the word. And I'd appreciate it if you'd pass it along too, Rockwell.
Sure. Some of the boys have been going out into the woods to do some hunting during their spare time. I'll tell them not to bother anymore.
Something else I'm wondering about. Why does Chamberlain need to hire so many bodyguards?
He's a rich man. Rich men have enemies. Chamberlain does especially. You ever hear of Emmett Bosworth?
Can't say as I have.
He's the boss's biggest competitor. He's got the second biggest logging operation in Northern California, and he'd like to have the biggest. Bosworth's managed to get some leases that Chamberlain wanted to get his hands on. Those two gents don't cotton to each other.
So Chamberlain's worried that this fella Bosworth might try to move in on him?
Yeah, there have already been some squabbles between logging crews over lease boundaries. That's when Chamberlain brought in me and Cobb and the other boys. All that sort of faded out over the past 6 months.
Since the terror showed up.
Yeah. The loggers are all more worried about the monster than they are about Bosworth. But Chamberlain kept us on anyway, since he figures he'll have more trouble with Bosworth sooner or later.
Frank turned Stormy's head and lifted a hand in farewell to Rockwell as he rode away. He wasn't exactly sure where he was going, but he knew he wouldn't be able to catch the terror here on Chamberlain's estate. If Nancy was right, and the creature really was her brother, Ben would probably avoid his father's house. And if Nancy was wrong, if the terror was some sort of mindless, animalistic monster, instinct would keep it from coming too close to the haunts of man. The trouble had started when the logging crews began to make their way deeper into the woods. Frank knew where the terror had been earlier in the day. He turned Stormy toward the south and rode slowly back the way he had come. Picking up the trail of the creature would be a long shot, but Frank was willing to give it a try. Considering everything he had seen earlier in the day, he wouldn't have been surprised if he'd found more mutilated bodies, but the forest seemed to be quiet and peaceful again. He heard an odd sound in the distance, but after a few minutes he figured out that it was axe blades biting deep into tree trunks. A logging crew was at work somewhere within hearing distance, but in this dense redwood jungle, it was impossible to tell how far away or even exactly which direction the sounds came from. After a while, Frank found the camp where he had first encountered the creature's bloody handiwork. After loading up the bodies to take them to Eureka, Carl Wilcox and the other loggers hadn't returned, so the place looked almost like it had when Frank left it. The campfire and its ring of stones had burned down and gone out, but not before boiling the coffee dry and scorching the bottom of the pot. The frying pan was the big difference, though. The bacon and biscuits that had been in it earlier were gone. Somebody had come along and helped himself, or itself, to the food. Frank dismounted and hunkered next to the ashes.
Wolf, take a whiff, boy. See what you smell around here.
Wolf circled the dead fire with his nose to the ground, pausing halfway around the ring of stones to lift his head and gaze off to the west. Frank knew that the Pacific Ocean lay only a few miles in that direction, the endless waves washing in over jagged rocks that lay at the bottom of steep cliffs. Between here and the sea, though, lay thousands of acres of thickly timbered woodland where the Terror could be hiding. Frank stood up and grasped Stormy's reins again.
All right, big fella, trail.
Wolf set off through the trees while Frank mounted up. He followed the big cur, leading Goldie. Wolf didn't range too far ahead, but even so, there were times when Frank couldn't see him. He followed the sounds of Wolf's passage through the undergrowth. As the brush thickened, the going became even slower and more difficult. Frank would have thought that the lack of direct sunlight under the towering redwoods would have kept other vegetation from growing so well, but obviously, these hardy plants had adapted. After half an hour or so, Frank and Wolf and the horses emerged from the woods, coming out into an open, park-like area about 50 yards wide. Beyond it, a rocky ridge jutted up about 100 feet. Part of it formed a sheer cliff. Redwoods lined the top of the cliff, growing right to the edge. At the base of it lay a tumbled mass of broken trunks and branches. It took Frank a moment to figure out what had happened. Over the centuries, erosion had eaten away at the cliff face so that some of the trees on top of it had lost their anchorage and fallen. Lightning strikes or windstorms might have toppled some of the other redwoods. The debris formed by those natural occurrences had scattered along the base of the cliff to form a maze of sorts, as if giant fingers had flung down a handful of matches and let them fall where they might. In places, the trees had stacked like makeshift walls. Wolf turned and started northward, still following the scent that had brought them this far, and Frank was about to follow him when something about the jumbled tree trunks along the cliff caught his attention.
Wait a minute, Wolf. I want to take a look over there.
Wolf looked in the direction he'd been going, then turned and came back as if he were humoring Frank. That brought a grin to the drifter's face. Wolf was a stubborn old cuss, sort of like Frank himself. Maybe that was one reason they got along so well. When Frank reached the edge of the tumbled-down tree trunks, he reined in and dismounted, leaving Stormy's reins dangling because he knew the rangy gray stallion wouldn't wander off. He started into the tangle of logs on foot. He hadn't gone very far before he realized what had caught his attention over here. Somebody had stacked up broken branches, some of which were as big around as the trunk of a regular tree, as well as the upper sections of the redwoods, which were much narrower than the bases, and made walls out of them. Those walls formed a crude cabin built up against the cliff face. From a distance, it looked natural and blended in with the rest of the jumbled logs. Densely intertwined branches formed the roof. Whoever had built this dwelling had left an open space for the door. An old blanket hung over it. Frank slid his Colt from its holster. Nancy Chamberlain had mentioned that her brother Ben had built a cabin for himself when he left home and moved to the woods. Was this it? And more importantly, was this the lair of the Terror? Frank moved closer, the heavy revolver gripped tightly in his hand. When he was about 10 feet from the blanket-covered doorway, he stopped.
Hello, the cabin. Anybody home? Ben! Ben Chamberlain!
Wolf had come up behind him. The big cur pressed against Frank's leg. Frank felt Wolf's muscles trembling and knew it wasn't from fear, but rather from the desire to explore inside that cave-like structure.
All right, Wolf, check it out.
Wolf bounded forward and pushed past the blanket to disappear into the cabin. Frank stalked closer, ready to go in with his gun blazing if he heard any commotion. Instead, a few moments later, Wolf reappeared. A few cobwebs clung to his wolf-like face, as if he had pushed his nose into some dusty, empty hole.
Nothing, huh?
Frank pushed the blanket aside with his left hand and thrust the gun in front of him with his right. Although the afternoon was well advanced now, and the sun would soon be dipping toward the horizon, enough light still spilled through the doorway for Frank to be able to see as he looked around the inside of the cabin. There was only one room. Whoever had built the place had dug a fire pit in the ground in the center and left some openings above it in the thatched roof for the smoke to drift out. On one side of the room was a crude bed, little more than some blankets piled up on some branches. Had to be uncomfortable as hell, Frank thought as he looked at it. On the other side of the room was the only real sign that a civilized person had ever lived here. An old wooden trunk with a curved lid sat there. Leather straps ran around it, but the leather was rotting now. It had brass corners and a brass latch, all of which were tarnished and dull. Frank went over to it and lifted the lid. He had no idea what he would find inside. A frown creased his forehead as he saw that the trunk was empty, except for a few books. The scent of mildew drifted up to his nose. The books had gotten wet at some point in the past, and they were moldering away now. He holstered his gun and knelt in front of the trunk and reached inside to pick up one of the leather-bound volumes. The smell was even stronger as he opened the book. He saw words written on the flyleaf. Moisture had caused the ink to run, but the writing was still legible. Property of Benjamin Andrew Chamberlain. Well, that pretty well answered his question about whether or not this was Ben's cabin. Out of curiosity, Frank turned the pages to the title page. 5 Weeks in a Balloon by Jules Verne. Frank smiled. He had read this one too, and he was willing to bet that this particular copy had come from the library in Rutherford Chamberlain's mansion. Maybe that edition of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea had belonged to Ben too. Frank put the book back and stood up, carefully closing the trunk's lid. Maybe the trunk and the books inside it were rotting away, but they belonged to Ben Chamberlain, and Frank made it a habit to respect other folks' property. He could come back for them, though, and take them to the Chamberlain mansion once he had returned Ben himself to that redwood edifice. He took a quick look around the rest of the cabin. His boot prints and Wolf's tracks were the only marks that disturbed the hard-packed dirt floor. No one had been here recently. That agreed with what Nancy had told him about her brother avoiding the cabin that had once been his home in the woods. Ben had hacked several cubby holes into the cliff face, probably using a hammer and chisel and enlarging openings that were already there. Frank could see the marks of the tools on the rock. The young man must have used them for storage of some sort, but they were empty now except for cobwebs. That explained how Wolf had gotten the silky strands stuck on his muzzle. He might have smelled the last vestiges of food scent in some of them and stuck his nose in to see what was there. Satisfied that he had seen everything there was to see, Frank turned toward the doorway. He stopped when he spotted something else from the corner of his eye, a flash of white from the corner where the crude bunk was. Something was wedged up between the branches and the cabin wall. Frank went over and knelt to reach in and pull it out. The shadows were starting to grow thick in here now, so he couldn't see very well. He thought maybe what he'd seen was a piece of paper. Instead, what his fingers encountered was a smooth cylinder of some sort, maybe an inch or a little more in diameter. It had a slight curve to it, he realized as he closed his hand around it, and started working it past the branches. His jaw tightened and his breath hissed between his teeth when he pulled the thing out and saw that it was a bone. He was no expert on anatomy, but he was pretty sure it was an arm bone from a human being. A sudden sick feeling made Frank's stomach clench. Still holding the bone, he stood up and moved closer to the doorway so the light would be better. He studied the thing closely, hardly wanting to admit, even to himself, that he was looking for teeth marks. A feeling of relief went through him as he realized the bone was still smooth. The flesh and sinew were gone, but they had been stripped away by insects rather than gnawed off. That made him feel a little better. Still, he couldn't help wonder how a man's arm bone had come to be here in this cabin that had belonged to Ben Chamberlain. Was it Ben's bone? Was Nancy's brother dead after all, as Frank had warned her that he might be? Or had the bone come from somebody else? He had no way of answering those questions right now, and the fading light reminded him that night would be falling soon. Frank wasn't a superstitious man, but clearly there was something in these woods that was dangerous, and he didn't particularly want to spend the night out here. He had a pretty good idea which way Eureka was from here. He would head for town, find a hotel room, and ride out here to take up the search for the terror again the next morning. Frank went over to the trunk, opened it again, and put the bone inside with the books. He would figure out what to do with it later, when he had a better idea who it belonged to.
Come on, Wolf. I don't want to spend the night out here, and I don't reckon you do either.
Frank pushed the blanket aside and stepped out of the cabin. Frank lifted his head and looked around. He caught a glimpse of orange flames in the shadows under the trees on the other side of the clearing as a bullet whizzed past his ear and smacked into the cabin wall behind him. Frank threw himself to the left, into the jumble of fallen trees. He crouched behind one of the massive redwood trunks, safe for the moment from the hidden rifleman's fire. Bullets wouldn't ricochet among these trees, as they might have if he had taken shelter in a cluster of boulders. Wolf was right next to him, having followed his lead. Stormy and Goldie were still out in the open, though, and Frank worried that the bushwhacker might turn his gun on the horses next.
Yeah, get out of here, you jugheads!
The horses turned and dashed away. Of course, that left Frank on foot for the moment, but that couldn't be helped. Staying low, he worked his way through the fallen trees, putting some distance between himself and the last place the bushwhacker had seen him, right in front of Ben Chamberlain's cabin. The hidden gunman hadn't fired since that first shot, but Frank's instincts told him the man was still out there, just waiting for another crack at him. He took his hat off so that its white crown wouldn't give away his position, and slowly raised his head until he could peer through an open space among the tree trunks. 50 yards was mighty long range for a handgun, but he thought that with luck and good aim, he could reach the trees on the other side of the clearing where the bushwhacker was hidden. He needed to get a little better idea of where the man was, though. Still holding his hat in his left hand, Frank slowly raised it and moved it in a slightly jerky, up-and-down motion from right to left, as if it were on his head while he was creeping along behind the trees. It was an old trick, but the reason it had been around for so long was that it usually worked. Frank flung the hat away from him like it had been hit, even though the bullet had missed. He had spotted the muzzle flash from the bushwhacker's rifle. Of course, the man might not stay in the same place, but that was all Frank had to go by, so he lined up his shot, figuring windage and elevation and distance with the instinctive skill of a man who had been using his guns for decades and was still alive. He squeezed the trigger. He couldn't see where the shot landed, but the rifle across the clearing suddenly started barking rapidly, the bushwhacker triggering rounds as fast as he could work the weapon's lever. After a couple of minutes, the rifle fell silent. Frank crawled about 10 yards to his left and found another gap in the trees big enough for him to peer through. He saw a flicker of movement under the trees opposite him, and a moment later he heard a horse riding off into the distance. A trick of some sort? Or had the bushwhacker really lit a shuck out of there? Once Frank had forded up in the fallen trees, the man might have decided that killing him was going to be more trouble than it was worth, and riskier, too. Frank retrieved his hat and then waited where he was. Patience had kept him alive more than once during the long, rugged years. The sun set during the next 15 minutes. By then, the light was bad enough that Frank risked moving out from his cover behind the trees. At his signal, Stormy and Goldie came trotting up.
Let's get out of here. It'll be dark by the time we make it to Eureka.
Actually, it was dark well before that. Frank, Wolf, and the two horses were still deep in the woods when the last of the light faded away, to be replaced by thick, shrouding shadows. Frank had been underground once in a cave, where there was no light at all. It wasn't quite that utterly dark under the trees, because a faint glow from the stars filtered down through the leafy canopy. But it was dark enough that he couldn't see his hand in front of his face. He had to trust Stormy's instincts and let the stallion find his own path, because he couldn't see well enough to guide the horse. Luckily, the redwood branches didn't start growing out from the trunks below a height of 80 or 90 feet, so he didn't have to worry about an unseen branch knocking him out of the saddle. After a while, Stormy started moving a little faster. The gray light from the stars increased too, and when Frank tilted his head back and looked up, he could actually see some of the little glowing pinpricks in the heavens above him. The tree canopy had thinned. There was a good reason for that. Frank realized that they were on a road now, more than likely one of the logging trails that Chamberlain's crew had cut into the forest. From what he could see of the stars, he thought he was headed northeast, which would take him toward Eureka. Suddenly, he reined in sharply as a sound came from somewhere behind him in the towering trees where he had been until a short time earlier. It was like the howl of an animal, but he had never heard a wolf or anything else that sounded exactly like that. It wasn't a howl of pain or anger or anything else that Frank could pin down. All he knew was that it was one of the loneliest sounds he had ever heard, and that he was damned glad he wasn't back there in the woods with whatever had made it.
Come on, Stormy. Let's get on to town.
Eureka was a large enough settlement so that Frank saw the lights of the place well before he reached it. Located on Humboldt Bay, Eureka was the center of the logging industry in this part of Northern California. Frank could tell it was a prosperous town by the number of 2- and 3-story brick buildings he saw as he rode down the main street. The street was paved with cobblestones. It had to be. Otherwise, in this rainy climate, it would be a morass of mud most of the time. Frank saw an impressive sign that read Chamberlain Logging Company on an even more impressive brick building. Given the house where Rutherford Chamberlain lived, Frank was a little surprised the company headquarters wasn't built out of redwood, too. He could also tell that Eureka was where the loggers came when they wanted to blow off some of the steam that built up because of their grueling, perilous profession. He passed the Bull o' the Woods Saloon, the Redwood Saloon, and the High Climbers Saloon. A place that discreetly called itself the Woodsman's Retreat had a red light burning in the window, so it was pretty obvious why the woodsmen retreated there. Like any boomtown, no matter whether the cause for the boom was gold, oil, or timber, Eureka was a mixture of high finance and low vice. Frank was hungry, but he wanted to find a place for his horses and a hotel room for himself before he went looking for a cafe. He stopped at the first stable he came to, Patterson's Livery and Wagon Yard. The proprietor, a stocky man with a short reddish-brown beard, came out of the barn wiping his hands on a rag and greeted Frank with a friendly nod.
Those are some mighty fine-looking horses, mister. You looking for a place to keep them for the night?
That's right. You have room?
Sure do. You'll be getting the last 2 empty stalls, though.
My dog's used to staying with the horses. Is that all right?
Is that a dog or a wolf?
He's a dog, but I call him Wolf since he looks like one, though.
Reckon I'll take your word for it. As long as he's tame and don't bother the other horses, he can stay here.
He won't cause any trouble.
I can unsaddle for you.
Better let me. This old hellion's been known to take a bite out of a man's hide when he wasn't looking. He sometimes takes a notion to kick, too.
One-man horse, eh? Well, you go right ahead. Plenty of grain in the bin. We didn't talk about the price.
No need. I'm sure it'll be fine. You don't strike me as a man who's in the habit of overcharging anybody.
Frank led the horses along the barn's center aisle to the 2 empty stalls. He unsaddled and rubbed down Stormy, then made sure that both horses had plenty of water and grain. The liveryman watched Frank tending to the animals.
You take good care of those critters, mister. Treat them like friends.
They are my friends. I tend to travel around a lot. Spend more time with them than anybody else.
I live out back. Got a soup bone in the kitchen that dog of yours can have, if that's all right.
We'd be obliged. And if you can point me to the best place in town to stay and to get a good meal, I'd be obliged for that, too.
Sure. The Eureka House is the nicest hotel, or so I've heard. They're supposed to have a good dining room, too. Or you can go across the street to Harrigan's Restaurant. Or, if you don't care about fancy and just want some good food, there's a hash house down by Bull of the Woods Saloon that's run by a Chinaman who's a mighty good cook. You won't go hungry in Eureka, that's for sure.
Good to know. Kinda gotten in the habit of eating.
Frank got directions to the Eureka House, then left the stable and set off up the street carrying his saddlebags slung over his shoulder and his Winchester in his left hand. He saw a large number of wagons parked in front of various buildings, but not too many saddled horses tied up at the hitch racks. Nor did he pass many people dressed like he was. Most of the pedestrians were either townsmen or loggers. This wasn't ranching country. The looks that Frank got from the people in the lobby of the Eureka House reminded him of that as he walked toward the desk. The men wore expensive suits and had pomaded hair. The women wore gowns with bustles and had their hair piled high on their heads in elaborate arrangements of curls. Frank didn't care. He got the same sort of reaction every time he walked into a hotel in Denver or San Francisco, and those towns were a lot bigger than Eureka. Still, if he told the truth, he'd have to admit that he got a little satisfaction out of the expression on the face of the clerk when he set the Winchester on the desk in front of him.
I'd like a room, please.
Do you intend to keep that weapon in the hotel?
That's right. A room for me and my Winchester.
I'm not sure if we have anything available.
Frank saw several keys hanging on their pegs. He took a $50 gold piece out of his pocket and slapped it on the desk.
I'll bet you do. Why don't you check and see?
Why, I believe we do have a room available, sir.
I thought you might.
The clerk turned the register around. Frank signed his name, and in the space where he was from, he wrote San Francisco. That wasn't exactly true, He wasn't really from anywhere anymore, since he was always on the drift. But some of his lawyers had offices in San Francisco, so that was as good a place to put down as any.
Will you be staying with us long, Mr. Morgan?
That depends. Keep that 50 and let me know if it runs out.
Of course. Do you have a preference as far as rooms go? We have one overlooking the street.
If you have anything on the back, I'd rather be there. Quieter, you know.
Yes, sir, certainly. Room 12 should do you nicely. Do you need any help with your belongings?
No, thanks. I reckon I can manage.
All right, then. Take the stairs to the balcony and go along it to a hallway. You'll find room 12 down that corridor.
Much obliged.
We have an excellent dining room if you haven't eaten.
I've heard about that, but I was thinking maybe I'd try the Chinaman's Hash House instead.
Mr. Morgan?
Yeah?
Frank Morgan?
That's right.
The man reached down to a shelf under the desk and took out a small thin book with a gaudy yellow cover.
This? Frank Morgan?
Oh, Lord. Are they still putting those things out?
Yes, sir. This is the new one. The Drifter and the Battle of Tonto Basin.
Those stories are all made up. I've been to the Tonto Basin, but I don't recall any battle while I was there.
But you are Frank Morgan, the famous gunfighter. I knew you were in the area. I heard some men talking about you earlier this evening. You've come to hunt down and kill the Terror of the Redwoods.
I'm here on business. My business. Understand?
Yes, sir.
Frank just shook his head and went on up the stairs. He had been dealing with fame, or rather notoriety, for a long time now, and he didn't like it any better than he had when he first started getting a reputation as a fast gun. He found his room, which appeared to be very comfortably furnished with a four-poster bed, dressing table, mahogany wardrobe, and a couple of armchairs. After washing up with the water in the basin on the dressing table, he left his saddlebags and rifle in the wardrobe and started back downstairs. He didn't think he would need the Winchester just to eat at the Chinaman's place. When he reached the lobby, the clerk he had talked to only a few minutes earlier wasn't there anymore. He'd been replaced by an older man with thinning black hair and a mustache. Frank didn't ask where the other clerk had gone. The fellow was probably out telling anybody who would listen to him how the infamous Frank Morgan was staying at the hotel. Frank stepped out onto the porch and turned toward the Bull of the Woods Saloon, the location of which he had noted earlier as he rode in. The proprietor over at the livery stable had said that the hash house was next to the saloon. Frank hadn't gotten very far, though, when a man who'd been crossing the street stepped in front of him, blocking his path.
Now hold it right there, Morgan. You and me got some business to take care of.
The man's aggressive stance made Frank instinctively want to reach for his revolver. But the sight of the badge pinned to the stranger's vest prompted him to control the impulse. He was a middle-aged man with a rugged face, slicked-back gray hair under his hat, and the beginnings of a gut under his vest and brown tweed suit.
Marshal, what can I do for you?
You know who I am, huh?
I can read. Your badge says Marshal. U.S. or town?
Town. Name's Gene Price, and I'm the law here in Eureka.
Pleased to meet you, Marshal. I reckon I don't have to introduce myself.
Oh, you sure don't. It's all over town how the famous gunslinger Frank Morgan's come here to hunt down that critter folks say is out in the woods.
You don't believe in the terror?
I believe somebody's killed over a dozen men lately. I saw the bodies with my own eyes down at the Undertaker's. That's all I know for a fact. That, and it happened outside of my jurisdiction.
So what do you want with me? There's no law against getting some supper, is there? Because that's what I was on my way to do.
No, and I don't care what you do out in the woods. But I don't want you starting any gunfights here in my town, Morgan.
Marshal, I never start gunfights.
You know what I mean. You got a heap of blood on your hands. I don't want you getting any more on them while you're in Eureka.
I never go looking for trouble. You have my word on that.
We understand each other then.
Marshal, what can you tell me about Rutherford Chamberlain?
Well, what do you want to know? He's the biggest businessman in these parts. I'm not saying that Eureka would dry up and blow away if it weren't for his logging operation, but I reckon he's mighty important around here.
And Emmett Bosworth?
Bosworth would like to be where Chamberlain is now. He's made a good start on it, too.
Any trouble between their crews while they were here in town?
Some. Not lately, though.
Since the terror showed up?
That's right. Everybody who works in the woods is so nervous about whatever it is, they don't have the time or energy to squabble with each other.
Do you know Ben Chamberlain?
Ben? Oh, yeah, well, sure I know Ben. Used to see him here in town every now and then, but he was never much of one for socializing. Kept to himself, mostly. And I haven't seen him at all in, oh, hell, a couple of years now, I reckon. I heard that he had some sort of falling out with his pa and went off to live in San Francisco. Now, that's just gossip, though. I can't say how true it is. You're asking a lot of questions, mister, considering that you're working for Rutherford Chamberlain.
I'd just like to know what I'm getting into, that's all.
Whatever you get into, do it somewhere else besides here.
Continuing down the boardwalk, Frank spotted the eatery next to the boisterous Bull of the Woods Saloon, which took up most of a block and had its entrance on a corner. A number of men in the caulked boots, overalls, and flannel shirts of loggers stood on the boardwalk in front of the saloon's big windows. They wore solemn expressions as they talked among themselves, and several of them cast glances toward Frank as he approached. Elbows nudged into sides, and one by one, the rest of the men turned their attention toward him, too. Frank paused outside the door of the hash house and gave them a friendly nod.
Evening.
None of the men responded. They just kept looking at him with blank or unfriendly stares. Frank didn't know what that was about, but he was too hungry to worry about it. He went on into the hash house. The place was long and narrow, with a counter on the right and a row of tables along the left-hand wall. Most of the tables were occupied, as were the stools in front of the counter. A swinging door at the end of it probably led into the kitchen. A man with a round, friendly face worked behind the counter. He was dark-haired, about 30 years old, and wore a white apron. Except for the slight slant of his eyes, he didn't really look Chinese. He smiled at Frank and waved him onto one of the empty stools.
What can I do for you, mister?
I'll have a bowl of stew and plenty of cornbread. Coffee hot?
You can bet that hat of yours it is.
Then fill a cup and keep it coming.
Sure thing.
The man's voice didn't have a hint of an accent, but when he turned to a small open window behind the counter and called through it, he spoke in what sounded to Frank's ears like fluent Mandarin. Not that Frank was an expert in Chinese dialects, but nearly 30 years earlier, he had spent some time in the Sierra Nevadas while hundreds of laborers from China had been building the Central Pacific Railroad through the mountains, and he had picked up a smattering of the lingo, just like he could speak a little of the tongues of several different Indian tribes, as well as a little German and French. Having grown up in Texas, though, he was better with Spanish than any other foreign language.
I'm Frank Morgan.
I've heard of you, Mr. Morgan. I suspect nearly everyone in Eureka has by this time. My name is Peter Lee.
Pleased to meet you, Peter. You sound like you've been in this country for a while.
As far back as I can remember, though I was born in China. I was 2 years old when my parents came here to work on the Central Pacific.
You grew up speaking English?
I did. You see, one of the supervisors took me in when my father was killed in an accident only a couple of months after we got here. My mother, well, I don't know what happened to her. She was gone by the time I was old enough to remember anything.
Some fellas might be a little bitter about that.
I never knew any difference. The people who raised me were good folks. Taught me how to work hard and take care of myself.
Well, looks like you're doing a fine job of it.
I do all right.
The door at the end of the counter swung open, and a very attractive young Chinese woman came through it carrying a bowl of stew, which she placed in front of Frank.
My wife and our children helped me run the place.
Mrs. Lee, it's a pleasure to meet you, ma'am.
She smiled and didn't say anything, just retreated back through the door into the kitchen. Frank picked up the spoon Lee placed on the counter beside the bowl and dug in. The stew smelled good and tasted better. It was full of big chunks of beef, potatoes, carrots, wild onions, and spices. Lee brought over a plate with a big hunk of cornbread on it, and when Frank sampled that, it was equally as good.
What brings you to Eureka, Mr. Morgan? As if I didn't know.
You heard about it, huh?
You're the talk of the town tonight. Some people are glad that a man with your reputation is going after the terror, while others are upset that Mr. Chamberlain isn't offering that $10,000 bounty anymore. And some of the loggers think that it would be better to have a lot of people hunting the monster instead of just one man.
What do you think, Mr. Lee?
Until that so-called terror comes in here and sits down at my counter, it's not really any of my business, is it?
Can't be good for your trade if it starts to cut into the logging that's going on around here.
That hasn't happened. Yet.
Lee moved off along the counter to refill other coffee cups, leaving Frank alone with his meal. For the next few minutes, he ate with great enjoyment. He should have known the peaceful respite wouldn't last. It had been his experience that they never did. Because of that, he wasn't really surprised when the door of the hash house opened and several men clumped into the long, narrow room. Frank glanced at them, saw that three of the newcomers were dressed in range clothes, while the other three were loggers.
Morgan, I want to talk to you.
This hombre didn't have a badge like Marshall Price, so Frank didn't see any good reason to talk to him. He spooned more stew into his mouth.
Damn it, I'm talking to you, Morgan, you deaf!
I just want to enjoy my supper, friend. And having to kill you would put a serious crimp in those plans.
Why, you...
Take it easy, Dawson. I'll handle this.
One of the other men stepped forward and brushed the belligerent one back. He was the biggest of the bunch, even bigger than the burly loggers. Long, dark red hair fell from under a high-crowned brown Stetson, and he sported a beard of the same hue.
Listen, Morgan. My name's Erickson. Maybe you've heard of me.
Can't say as I have.
The talk's all around town about how you're gonna hunt down the Terror. Because of you, Rutherford Chamberlain took back the bounty he put on the monster. We don't like that. My friends and I planned on finding that critter ourselves.
That's too bad. But you probably just would have gotten yourself killed by the other fellas who were out there hunting for the Terror.
That's our lookout, not yours. Not only that, but you killed Jingo Reed and busted Matt Sewell's shoulder so that he'll never be the same again. Jingo and Matt were good men. Friends of mine. You ride out in the morning and keep going. Leave this part of California. Leave the Terror to us. You do that, and we'll let what happened to Jingo and Matt slide. This time.
And if I'm not interested in doing that?
You'll be sorry.
Please, Mr. Morgan, if there's a gunfight in here, innocent people might be hurt. That wall between us and my family isn't thick enough to stop a bullet.
There's not going to be a gunfight.
You're going to get out of town?
Nope. But you're not going to make me draw on you either. I promised the marshal I wouldn't kill anybody in his town if I could help it.
You son of a bitch. So you're not going to draw on me, are you?
No, I'm not.
Erickson reached over and picked up the coffee cup that Frank had set down on the counter. The cup was still about half full. Erickson tilted it, as if he were about to pour the coffee on Frank's head. The drifter's hand shot up and clamped around Erickson's wrist, the fingers closing like iron bands.
I said, I wasn't going to get in a gunfight with you. I never said anything about not beating the hell out of you if you want to push it that far.
Erickson let go of the cup. Erickson then threw a pile driver punch with his other hand. It might have connected, if not for the fact that Frank squeezed the other wrist with such force that the bones ground together. Frank ducked the punch and hammered a blow of his own into Erickson's midsection. He stumbled back a step as Frank let go of his wrist. That put him in position for the sharp crossing left that Frank slammed into his jaw. Still seated on the stool in front of the counter, Frank brought his right leg up, planted his booted foot in Erickson's belly, and shoved him hard. Erickson flew backward to crash down in a heap at the feet of the men who had come into the hash house with him.
Get the bastard!
The loudmouth called Dawson led the charge. He came at Frank swinging wild punches. Frank stood up and grabbed the stool he'd been sitting on, raising it sharply with the legs pointed at Dawson so that the man's momentum carried him right into it. Frank dropped the stool and clouted Dawson on the jaw with a hard looping right. The punch drove Dawson to the floor, where the next man to attack, one of the loggers, tripped over him and fell forward. Frank was ready for it, meeting him with a left jab that made blood spurt from the man's nose as it pulped under Frank's fist. The logger fell to his knees. The space between the counter and the tables was narrow enough so that all of Frank's opponents couldn't charge him at the same time. The men who'd been eating supper in the hash house scrambled to get out of the way as the last man in range clothes and one of the other two loggers bulled their way around their fallen comrade, knocking over one of the tables as they did so. The man in range clothes grabbed a chair and lifted it over his head as he rushed in. Frank snatched the stool from the floor again and used it to block the chair as it descended. That bone-jarring impact snapped the legs off the chair.
Stop it! Please, don't bust up my place!
The man who had wound up holding two broken chair legs came at Frank, slashing back and forth with the makeshift clubs. Frank had to give ground as he tried to fend off the blows with the stool he still held. Recklessly, his opponent came too close, so when Frank saw his opportunity, he lifted his leg and kicked the man in the groin. The man dropped the broken chair legs as he clutched at himself and curled up in agony. That still left three men on their feet, though, because Erickson had managed to get up again. He looked like a berserk Viking as he came at Frank. Frank dropped the stool again and bent over to let Erickson's wild flailing punches sail harmlessly over his head. He drove forward, burying a shoulder in Erickson's midsection. As the big gunman's momentum carried him forward over Frank's back, Frank grabbed him around the thighs and lifted. Erickson came completely off the floor and turned a flip as Frank heaved the man over his back. That left two of the loggers facing Frank, and they hesitated now as Erickson rolled onto his side, tried to push himself up, and failed. He then slumped back down and lay still. One of the loggers held his hands palms out toward Frank.
That's enough, mister. By God, that's enough.
You boys called the tune. If you don't want to dance it, that's your business.
Forget it, Morgan. I don't want to tangle with you.
Frank nodded and bent down to check Erickson's pockets. He found a double eagle and flipped it to Peter Lee.
That ought to pay for the broken chair and anything else that got busted, as well as the food that was ruined. Fair enough, Peter?
Fair enough. Erickson may not feel that way when he gets his senses back, though.
Then he should have thought twice before he came in here to make trouble. What did you do, go in the bull of the woods and get Erickson and his friends all stirred up?
Don't blame us, Morgan. Erickson was already hot under the collar. A lot of men in Eureka feel the same way tonight. They don't like you coming in here and taking over the hunt for the terror like you done. But hell, you're just one man. You can't stop that monster.
You'd rather have 100 trigger-happy fools blundering around in the woods shooting at anything that moves, including you?
The loggers just frowned. They didn't have an answer for that. Frank shook his head in disgust.
If any of you fellas have a problem with what happened, you can take it up with me. If I hear about anybody bothering Mr. Lee or his family just because this little freak has happened in his place, I won't take it kindly, and I'll be looking for whoever's responsible.
He picked up his hat, which had got knocked off during the brief brawl, and waved it at the men on the floor.
Get them out of here. They're cluttering up Mr. Lee's place.
Dawson was able to stand up and stumble out of the hash house under his own power. So was the man with the broken nose, which was still leaking crimson. The loggers helped the other two out, including a groggy Erickson, who kept shaking his head. Peter Lee and his pretty wife and their two little kids, a boy and a girl about 5 and 6 years old, came out from behind the counter to clean up the mess left by the fight. Frank pitched in to help, and so did some of the customers who hadn't fled as soon as they had the chance.
Yeah, I'm sorry about this, Peter.
It wasn't your fault.
Well, maybe I could have tried a little harder to head it off before anybody started throwing punches. Seems the good Lord didn't put much backup in me when he made me, though.
I got that impression. You want some more stew and cornbread?
I did sort of work up an appetite again.
I'll see what's left out in the kitchen.
While Frank waited for Lee to come back, he became aware that the proprietor's two children were staring at him. He smiled at them, which caused them to scurry off behind their mother's skirts and then peep out at him timidly. Mrs. Lee just gave Frank a tired smile and herded the youngsters back into the kitchen. The customers who were left returned to their meals. A few minutes later, Lee brought Frank a fresh bowl of stew and another piece of cornbread, as well as refilling his coffee cup. Frank dug in and was enjoying the food when he heard someone enter through the hash house's front door and walk toward him. When he glanced over, he saw Marshal Gene Price approaching him. The lawman wore a scowl on his rugged face.
I thought I told you not to start any trouble in my town, Morgan.
I didn't start it.
That is not how I heard it. I heard you were in here brawling with half a dozen men.
Well, that's almost true, but there were actually only 4 of them who got into the fight. The other 2 decided they didn't want any part of it.
And you didn't start it.
1 against 6. Do I look like a fool to you, Marshal?
You got enemies here. It'd be better all the way around if you just rode out and didn't come back.
Not until I finish the job I said I'd do.
I could just throw you in jail, you know.
On what charge?
Assault. Disturbing the peace.
That's not how it happened, Marshal. Those men came in here looking for Mr. Morgan, intending to cause trouble. They attacked him. He was just defending himself.
You sure about that?
Ask any of my customers. They were all here when it happened.
The lawman turned to look at the men, several of whom nodded in agreement to what Lee had just said.
All right, then. I'll be keeping my eye on you, Morgan. You break the law, you're going to wind up behind bars before you know what happened.
I always try to be a law-abiding man, Marshal.
Price turned to stalk out of the hash house. Frank watched him go.
You may have made yourself an enemy there, Peter.
Marshal Price is a windbag. I'm not worried about him. I don't think Erickson and his cronies will bother us either. You made it pretty clear what would happen if they did.
I couldn't do much about it if I was dead.
Don't get yourself killed, then.
Words to live by.
Goddamn son of a bitch. Bastard. Shit.
The logger with the broken nose was named Royalston. He sat at a big table in the back of the Bull of the Woods saloon holding a bloody rag to his nose. The other men at the table ignored him. The one who'd been kicked in the groin sat gray-faced and hunched over. His name was Treadwell, and at this moment he wanted to kill Frank Morgan more than he had ever wanted anything else in his life. Big red-bearded Erickson wanted to kill Morgan, too. But even more than that, he wanted to collect the $10,000 bounty on the head of the Terror. With Morgan around, the chances of doing that were slim.
It don't matter. Let Morgan go after that damn monster. It'll tear him into little bloody pieces, the same way it's done with everybody else I'm lucky enough to run into it.
I wouldn't count on that. Morgan's not like most men. He wouldn't have lived as long as he has with the rep he's got if he wasn't plenty tough.
Those fellas who ran into the Terror were tough, too. Damn thing tore him apart like a wolf with a rabbit. That's why there needs to be more than one man going after it. It may take an army to get it.
Not an army, just a handful of men. If they're the right men, like us.
I'm not going back out there. Not to cut trees for Chamberlain. He's not paying me enough to risk my life with nothing but an axe and maybe a six-gun to defend myself.
Then come with us. You and Jenkins and Sutherland. The six of us. We'll find the Terror and kill it.
What's the point in that? The old man lifted the bounty. He won't pay $10,000 for the monster's head anymore. Not unless Morgan brings it in.
He'd put the bounty on it again quick enough. If Morgan was dead.
Are you saying what I think you're saying?
Once Morgan's out of the way, there'll be nobody stopping us from going after the Terror. And Chamberlain's bound to pay off once we get it.
Forget it. They say Morgan's as fast as Smoke Jensen or Matt Bodine. What you're talking about is a good way to get us killed.
Six against one. Those are mighty good odds.
Yeah, you would have thought so.
That was different. He had the edge because we couldn't all rush him at once.
And what you're talking about now is murder.
What I'm talking about now is $10,000, you damn fool. Even split six ways, that's more money than you can make in 3 or 4 years.
Well, you're right about that.
Of course I'm right.
But we'll be risking our lives going up against Morgan.
You're not already risking your lives by going into the woods where that monster is?
You're right about that. Count me in. Yeah, me too.
How about it?
All right. I'll throw in with you too, Erickson. I don't much like it, but $10,000 is a hell of a lot of money.
It sure is.
We'll have to go out to the camp and get our gear. Then we'll come back into town. I don't cotton to the idea of spending another night in those woods.
And then tomorrow, we'll start trying to figure out a way to get rid of Morgan. Right?
We're with you.
The three loggers left the saloon. Dawson watched them go.
I liked a three-way split of that reward money better than divvying it up six ways.
It'll still be a three-way split. Those dumb woodsmen will come in handy while we're getting rid of Morgan, and then when we go after the Terror. But once we've got the monster's head, we won't need them anymore. Now will we? Yeah. I think the Terror of the Redwoods is going to claim at least 3 more victims before we collect that $10,000 reward.
After Frank had breakfast the next morning in the hotel dining room, where the food was all right, but not as good as that served up by Peter Lee and his family, he headed for Patterson's livery and wagon yard. The proprietor was working on a wagon's broken axle as Frank came up.
Morning, Mr. Morgan. I hear you got mixed up in a little excitement last night.
You could call it that. I'm getting a mite old for so much excitement, though. I'm a little stiff and sore this morning.
Wolf must have heard Frank's voice. He came bounding out of the livery barn, tail wagging. Frank grabbed the big cur by his shaggy ruff as Wolf stood up and put his front feet on Frank's shoulders. He scratched Wolf's ears.
This old boy give you any trouble last night?
Nope, not a bit. Tell you the truth, I slept a little better than usual knowing he was in the barn. Anybody who tried to sneak in and steal anything would have been in for a surprise.
That's the truth. I'll be leaving Stormy here today. That's the gray I was riding yesterday. And taking Goldie out instead.
Going monster hunting, are you?
Huh. Word does get around in a hurry, doesn't it?
All over town. A lot of people aren't too happy about it either. They don't like it that Mr. Chamberlain took back that bounty, and they think more than one man ought to be going after the terror.
What do you think?
I'd say it depends on who that one man is.
Frank saddled Goldie and rode out of Eureka with Wolf loping along at his side. He headed southwest, where the thickly wooded land bulged out past Humboldt Bay and was back in the green twilight world under the towering redwoods, surrounded by their trunks like the legs of giants. That took him in the direction of the crude cabin he had discovered the day before. He hadn't forgotten that Wolf had been following a trail of some sort when they came across the cabin. It hadn't rained during the night, so Frank thought there was a good chance Wolf could pick up the scent again. Frank wished he had gotten a look at the bushwhacker the day before, even though he might not have recognized whoever it was. Wolf ran ahead, as usual. It took all of Frank's instinctive skill to guide him back to the spot where Wolf had first picked up the trail the previous day. When they found the place where the men had died at the hands, or whatever, of the terror, Wolf cast around until he caught the scent again.
Wolf! Hunt!
The big cur took off through the trees, with Frank following on Goldie. By mid-morning, they reached the open area and the cliff with the tumbled tree trunks piled at its base. Frank reined in at the edge of the trees and dismounted. He looked across the clearing at the cabin, which showed no signs of any other visitors since the day before. Letting Goldie's reins dangle, Frank explored the edge of the trees on foot, looking for anything that might tell him who had hidden here and taken those shots at him. The only thing he found was the stub of a quarrelie, which meant absolutely nothing because there were hundreds, if not thousands, of men in the area who rolled smokes just like this. Frank could tell that this one had been pinched out before the man who'd been smoking it threw it down. That told Frank the man knew at least a little something about how to act in the woods. Discarding a still-lit quarrelie could start a forest fire that might burn thousands of acres. With no other clue to tell him who ambushed him, Frank turned his attention back to the cabin. He took hold of Goldie's reins and led the horse across the clearing, then left him outside the jumble of fallen trees while he and Wolf checked out the primitive dwelling that Ben Chamberlain had made for himself. Everything still looked the same inside. Frank lifted the lid of the trunk and saw the books and the long, slender bone he had put there. Giving in to an impulse, Frank took the bone from the trunk and carried it outside, where he rolled it up into the slicker that was tied on behind his saddle. He had in mind taking it back to Eureka with him later on, finding one of the local doctors, and asking the man to confirm his opinion that the bone was human.
All right, Wolf. You can still follow that scent. Let's see where it leads. Trail!
Wolf still had the scent. He took off, heading north. Frank followed. Their course paralleled the ridge, which gradually tapered down until it was gone, and the trees closed in around them again. Wolf turned west then, toward the Pacific. Frank knew they couldn't go very far in that direction before they would come to the ocean. After a few minutes, he heard sounds that told him that a logging crew was working somewhere nearby. The recent deaths had everybody worried, but work had to go on. He came to a road that had been cut through the forest. Deep ruts told him that wagons traveled it regularly. He suddenly heard a noise, and after a moment, recognized it as the sound of a donkey engine. Those steam engines had a number of uses in a logging operation, Frank knew, so the presence of one meant that he must be close to one of Chamberlain's work camps. Wolf was still following the scent he'd first picked up the day before. It led toward the camp, Frank realized. A frown creased his forehead. Would the terror, whatever it was, attack a whole camp full of loggers? It had done exactly that the day before, Frank reminded himself, although to be fair, that camp was only a small one. That crew hadn't had a donkey engine with them. This camp would be a larger one, with more men on hand in case of trouble. Frank stiffened in the saddle for a second as he heard the shots, pistols and rifles, even a shotgun. There was a battle going on up there. Was it a battle between men, or between men and a monster? Wolf heard the shots too, and recognized them as the sound of trouble. He raced ahead. Frank urged Goldie to a faster pace along the rough road. The gunfire stopped, then an eerie silence fell over the forest, broken only by the donkey engine's racket. There were no animal sounds. The rumble of the engine would have scared away most of the creatures who lived in these woods. The explosions of guns would have sent the rest fleeing. Wolf ran around a bend in the road and out of sight. A second later, Frank heard the big cur. He pulled his Winchester from the saddle sheath and had it ready in his hands as he used his knees to guide Goldie around the curve. He came in sight of a large clearing, dotted with the stumps of the trees that used to be there. Tents were set up among the stumps. A couple of wagons were parked to one side of the clearing, and the mule teams that had brought them here were pinned up in a pole corral nearby. The donkey engine was still running. Steam rose from the funnel-shaped stack on top of the large cylindrical boiler, and the gears it drove still turned, winding a thick metal cable around a drum. That cable snaked off into the woods. Frank knew the other end would be wrapped around a log that was being dragged out of the forest. This was a collection point. A number of felled redwoods were lined up end to end in the clearing, ready to be hooked together and dragged along the road by a team of oxen, or possibly by a larger donkey engine that could be brought out when the crew was ready to transport these logs to the sawmill. Those thoughts went through Frank's head for a second when he saw the steam engine mounted on its low, wheeled platform and lashed in place with thick ropes between several stumps. The other things he saw around the clearing drove everything else out of his mind. Bile rose in Frank's throat at the sight of the bloody heaps that had been men. It looked like the Terror had gone on another killing spree. Frank counted the corpses, feeling sicker with each one. There were 11 dead men in this camp. Wolf stood stiff-legged a short distance from the carnage. The coppery reek of fresh blood probably bothered him as it mixed with the sharp tang of powder smoke lingering from the shooting. The smell bothered Frank, that was for sure. Sitting still in the saddle, Frank gazed around the clearing. The Winchester was in his hands. He was ready to snap the rifle to his shoulder and open fire instantly if he caught sight of the thing that had done this. Then he remembered his promise to Nancy Chamberlain. He had told her that he would do his best to bring her brother home safely. He couldn't just gun down Ben Chamberlain. Yet, how could he try to capture a thing that could do this? Nothing moved in the woods. After several minutes had gone by, Frank was convinced that whatever had carried out this mass murder was gone. Even so, he kept the rifle in one hand as he dismounted. He stepped over a man's arm that had been sheared off cleanly at the shoulder and flung across the camp. A few feet away lay a man who still had both arms, but no head, only a stump of a neck like the tree stumps that dotted the clearing. Frank moved on past several more bodies, all of them awash in gore from the deep wounds that covered their bodies. He had never seen anything like it in his life. And as he looked closer, he realized that was true. He hadn't seen anything exactly like this before, not even the previous day when he had stumbled across those victims of the Terror. With a puzzled frown on his face, he turned and went back to the first body he had looked at, the one without a head. After studying it for a moment, he forced himself to ignore the revulsion he felt and picked up the severed arm nearby so that he could take a closer look at it.
Well, what do you know about that?
Carefully, he bent over and placed the arm back on the ground where he had found it. The authorities would need to take a look at this scene of death and destruction, and it might be a good idea to leave it as much like he'd found it as possible. There was nothing he could do for these men, except try to find whoever was responsible for their grisly deaths.
Come on, Wolf.
He mounted up again and rode into the woods. Wolf wanted to pick up the trail he had been following earlier, but Frank had something else in mind. He started making a circle around the clearing where the logging camp was located, trying to stay about 50 yards out from it. If he hadn't found what he was looking for by the time he rode all the way around the camp, he would move out a little farther and try again. It took him about half an hour of careful searching before he found a spot where a number of horses had stood not long before. He couldn't see their hoof prints on the thick carpet of fallen needles, but to his experienced eye, the fresh droppings told the story as plainly as if it had been written out with pen and ink or printed in a book.
A number of riders made their way through the forest to this point and stopped their horses and left the mounts standing here for a while. Probably one member of the party held the reins. The others crept forward, using the trees for cover until they reached the edge of the loggers' camp. They opened fire with their rifles, took the woodsmen by surprise and probably killed several of them with the first volley.
The loggers who hadn't been killed outright had put up a fight. Frank had heard the evidence of that with his own ears. But they hadn't been able to mount enough of a defense to keep the bushwhackers from cutting them down one by one. Finally, all of Chamberlain's men were dead. Then the riflemen had come out of hiding to take care of the second part of their job. With axes they had either brought with them or found in the camp, they had walked among their victims, swinging the keen-edged weapons again and again as they chopped their victims to pieces. Frank had noticed that something was different about the severed arm he'd found, but it had taken him a few minutes to realize what it was. The day before, he had seen what the terror of the Redwoods left behind after an attack. The wounds were ragged, not clean. Flesh that had been torn and shredded looked different from flesh that had been cut. Men had committed murder here, not a monster. But would anyone else have noticed that? Frank wondered. Or would they have seen just more evidence of the terror's bloodthirsty rage? Would they have been blinded by blood and revulsion and failed to see the truth? Frank thought there was a pretty good chance that was exactly what would have happened.
Come on, Wolf. Let's see what else we can find.